This is Ozarks at Large. Voicing displeasure through protest is an American right and an American tradition. From Patrick Henry to Rosa Parks, Americans have, by voice or by action, changed or attempted to change parts of the status quo for centuries. Last weekend, millions participated in marches aimed at the new president on Saturday. And on Sunday, thousands in Arkansas took part in the state's version of the March for Life, calling for an end to legalized abortion. Other such marches are taking place this week, including a National March for Life in Washington, D.C. Friday. Sometimes the roots of resistance can be found in places many of us might find surprising. In her new book, Prison Power: How Prison Influenced the Movement for Black Liberation, Lisa Corrigan explores how people incarcerated for seeking civil rights were able to connect and plan. Lisa Corrigan is an associate professor of communication and director of the Gender Studies program at the University of Arkansas. She says she spent the better part of 10 years researching and writing the book.
And I changed it. So the first draft of it looks remarkably different than what is out in print now. So there were huge changes. The entire conclusion is totally different. Not a single word is the same. And chapter one is almost totally different. So it has changed.
Different because you just had more time to think about it, or different because you found different research, or?
Different because I wanted to make a totally new contribution to the literature. So I wanted to make a different kind of intervention into what people were saying about social movements generally, about the Black Freedom Movement specifically, and about the contribution of prisons. And so the first draft of the book was talking about what it means to regenerate Black freedom ideas and how they circulate. And the version now that's in print that people can get is about the contribution of prisons themselves as a sort of reflexive space for Black power especially. And it was a creative space to go into and learn about your fellow activists and innovate in the movement. And then it also changed and became something that really hampered Black liberation because the state took it over and used it against civil rights activists.
Let's take the first part of that, because it seems counterintuitive for many of us to think of prison as a place that could be a contribution.
It is, though. I mean, Americans, especially after 1960, have a very punitive notion of justice. And so they want retributive justice. They want an eye for an eye. They want people to get punished. But there's another really flourishing notion of justice. It's about restorative justice, and that means making people whole so that they're not acting in ways that the dominant culture might find delinquent. And for the civil rights activists going into the prisons after the Montgomery bus boycott, during the sit-ins in 1961 and later, that was really a space of solidarity. And for the young kids, the SNCC leaders and the college students and the high school students in some cases that were using the sit-ins as a space of creatively occupying, you know, white supremacist businesses and interstate transportation, they really saw the potential for prison to bring more Black middle-class protesters into the movement. So it's really hard to ignore the role of county jails and prisons and penitentiaries if you're not connected to people who are in them. But once your kids go in for sitting in at a hamburger counter or at a drugstore, then you're also drawn in. And so many of the members of the civil rights movement throughout its phases went into the prisons, and they were regular people. They were school teachers and janitorial custodial staff and bankers and, you know, taxi drivers, and they were regular people. And the encounter with the prison really made clear how power worked for them, how white power worked for them. You couldn't hide from it in the prison. It was very clear about what brutality looks like.
Then the other half of the statement, I mean, then, of course, the more punitive sort of environment takes over.
Yeah. And so I look at, you know, at how the state expanded prisons explicitly to disrupt civil rights. So Michelle Alexander has a wonderful popular book called The New Jim Crow that everybody should go read, and it's great. And she locates this contemporary moment we're in, this mass incarceration moment in the Reagan administration. And she's not wrong. I mean, the Reagan administration really increased the number of especially Black men in America's prisons. But that was a long time coming and really started with the Law Enforcement Assistance Act, which passed during the Johnson administration. administration and was explicitly taking aim at civil rights activists, and it created these block grants that the states could apply for, and the states could apply for them, and so could local police departments. And so if you were a police department and you wanted this federal money, you got 25% matching if you wanted to do in community engagement, and you got 75% matching if you wanted dual-use military-grade technologies that were coming out of the war in Vietnam. And so many urban police departments applied for the 75% that gave them, you know, the riot gear. And that completely transformed American policing practices and the penitentiary, quite frankly. And so, you know, where it was a creative space, certainly early in the Southern civil rights movement, as the Black freedom struggle became more northern and more urban, then the penitentiary took over. And there's a huge difference between spending a couple nights in a county jail and spending 10 years in solitary confinement in the penitentiary.
Institutionalized, yeah.
And I mean, just like the difference in connections to communities, the difference in brutality inside, the kind of torture that happens in county jails still in the United States looks totally different than what's happening in large-scale penitentiaries. Or, I mean, The Atlantic had a wonderful piece, a series of pieces last year in February about these black ops sites in Chicago, these prisons that are off the grid. If you disappear into one, there's no record that the state has you. And so the Black Power movement, as it was recruiting from penitentiaries and jails, was really thinking then about what it means to be a prisoner in the United States as a black man or woman, and about how most acts, especially property crimes, are really acts that define the prisoner as a political prisoner, as someone struggling both in a country that has always seen black people as property and as propertyless. And so even though the penitentiary became larger and policing became more brutal as a result of the state backlash against civil rights, it also then created this whole new vein of theorizing about the role of prison in a democracy and the role of black people in disrupting the power of the prison.
You have the advantage of some prison autobiographies that give you an eyewitness account.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that especially after Malcolm X's autobiography, which is just such a fantastic book, those autobiographies of members of the Black Power movement that were or incarcerated were on the bestseller lists for years. They sold out so many, you know, printings, and they were well read on college campuses and among white people. And so there's a sense at which the prison autobiographies are really critical in helping to explain for black people what it means to participate in black freedom struggle as an activist or to be radicalized, say, from prison. But for white readers, and there were a ton of them, especially in the 70s, that were reading these prison autobiographies, it was an insight that they couldn't have access to otherwise, because so few, certainly white intellectuals, have any encounters with prison. And poor white folks do. I mean, poor white folks understand the prison, right? But for the intelligentsia or for the educated middle class, for the bourgeoisie, they hadn't had run-ins with the prison. And so it became a space for white eavesdroppers to think about, you know, civil rights activism differently. And that is a contribution that I think continues. I mean, you're seeing right now in this moment all of these new documentaries and books about prison industrial complex. And that's really an outgrowth of those autobiographies from the 70s.
You know what's so interesting is almost everything tied up with your book, Prison Power, and the subject we're talking about don't happen overnight. You know, these are long game things. You go back to the Johnson administration and block grants. And so it's hard for a lot of us to see them happening as they're happening.
Oh, but you're not seeing them at all.
Yeah. With the benefit of hindsight and a book, you go, oh, this led to this. But it's a complicated.
Yeah, I mean, especially for us in Arkansas, you know, the Southern prison is a relatively new phenomenon. It emerged after Reconstruction. So when all of those Southern politicians came back after the Northern Army left and they passed the Black Codes, all of the Southern states except for Tennessee passed anti-loitering statutes. And those loitering statutes said that if you're not working in a contract as a sharecropper on a farm in the South, you could be jailed for 30 days to life for not working back on the plantation where you or your family had been held as a slave. And so they built all of these new prisons. Cummins in Arkansas is one. Parchman in Mississippi is another. And they were built on plantations, and they functioned that way. And some of them still do. Some of the southern penitentiaries still turn a profit. They still farm on them, and the state sells what they make for profit. So there is a sense where, yes, you're right, that some of these events have unfolded over a long period of time. But in terms of the prison itself, it's been a fairly stable growth, you know, really, especially in the South since the Civil War ended. And it has played the same role in Southern culture the entire time, you know, since the country reconstructed itself.
After 10 years, the book's published. Do you come away with any sense of optimism?
That's a hard question. I'm not an optimist by nature. That's not really a vector in which I participate a whole lot. I'm hopeful. I would choose hope rather than optimism.
Okay.
I'm hopeful because I think that at least around the war on drugs in this country, there is a different kind of conversation emerging about the punitive nature of punishing people who are associated with, you know, the drug culture. And in my mind, obviously, drugs are a public health issue, and they should not be an issue of, you know, punitive reprobation. But I think that that's probably the only place right now where there's some leverage. And if we look at somewhere like Colorado that has legalized cannabis, what are you seeing is a bunch of white men controlling cannabis production, cultivation, and sales. And it's not like they let all the black and brown folks in Colorado out of jail now that our culture has changed to say, oh, right, you know, smoking weed and drinking beer are more similar than not. And there are reasons why we would not want to criminalize, you know, the consumption of these things. And you're going to see that in Arkansas, too, you know, with the cultivation of medical marijuana, which it will, I think, lead to recreational marijuana down the road. Probably not soon, but it will. That's one place where I think the war on drugs is de-escalating. But I think with this, you know, recent incarnation of xenophobia, anti-immigrant sentiment, I think we're going to see a much larger police state, much more surveillance in the next 4 years. And I think that the prisons will fill again, more so than they are now.
Aren't we at a tipping point? I mean, aren't we at the saturation point now?
Yeah, but I mean, they're building new ones. Uh-huh. I mean, in the South and in Arkansas, the predictor for new prison beds is the literacy mm-hmm. of third grade black boys. So they're actually building prisons
based on 10 years out.
Well, based on withholding resources for poor rural Americans. That is, and the problem is that for a lot of states, and Arkansas is not a leader on this, thankfully, you know, a lot of states are using private prisons. And so if you have a private prison and there are people who are in prison, there's no federal oversight. So there is tremendous torture happening in those prisons. I mean, there's sexual abuse, there's physical abuse, there are, I mean, tremendous infestations of disease, and there's no oversight for them. And so the further that America goes down the path towards privatizing, you know, prisons like they are with education and everything else, the wheels fall off and there's no public accountability. And that really should disturb everyone. And that's not to say that there aren't reasons why you would want to consider other options either for incarceration or public education. But in the South, they're connected. They're connected in the budget. They're connected in the way that we talk about what people should be doing or shouldn't be doing. They're connected in terms of resources, and they should be thought about as, you know, co-constitutive political ideas.
You mentioned in the 1970s, those prison autobiographies topping the New York Times bestsellers list, and as you described, white eavesdroppers having a chance now.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a chance that's happening now? I mean, we have such a different media landscape than we did mm-hmm. in the 1960s and 70s. there are probably people who want to eavesdrop, want to know more, but don't know how.
Well, you know, so I should tell the listeners can't see me, but as a white woman who writes about Black Power and has been working as a rhetorical historian in this area for almost 25 years, there is a space, I think, for white people to be better allies and to be much more critical readers and thinkers about race issues and to go beyond wanting to be a good person, to be well-informed. And so there is a call now, I think, for especially millennials to pay attention to media and participate in creating media differently. And that is very, I'm hopeful about that, that there are millennials who are thinking about race now differently than Gen X did, certainly different than the boomers did. And there's a space there, I think, to really build upon for the millennial generation, no matter how oftenly they're derided, I think wrongly mostly. I also think that there are white eavesdroppers, especially online, but it functions in two ways. One is sort of like watching Black Twitter unfold and participating in Black public culture from the outskirts. And that happens a lot on Facebook and Twitter. But I think that then there's also trolling. And so the other side of that is that when you have white listeners who are panicking about the loss of unearned privileges accrued by virtue of their whiteness, then they become trolls. And so that creates a very hostile intellectual environment, which makes it very hard for people of color or white allies to, I think, function in healthy ways. And so, yes, there's cause for hope, I think. But on the other hand, it would be remiss to understand this political moment as something other than a white supremacist backlash moment. And in part, that's part of the founding of the country, is this notion that property should be white. But I think that for the most part, for as wealthy as the country is, as educated as we have the potential to be, we can do better.
Lisa Corrigan is an associate professor of communication and director of the Gender Studies Program at the University of Arkansas and the author of the new book, Prison Power: How Prison Influenced the Movement for Black Liberation. The book is available locally at Nightbird Books in Fayetteville and at major online booksellers. This is Ozarks at Large.